history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that really need to be told. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And when we do that, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Now, that book, The Greatest Generation, is on the table right over there. Tom Brokaw's classic about our World War II vets, and we're with a World War II Marine today in Albuquerque, New Mexico, Leopoldo Griego, 95 years old, and you've lived here in the Duke City pretty much all your life?
Yes, I was born in then the Villa de los Rancho, they call it. I was born where Pueblo Road is and 4th Street. There's a beautiful house across the street, and that's where I was born. It's only about 3 miles from here where I live.
Uh-huh.
So born and raised, and I went to the CC camp. I still got a picture I'm going to show you when I went this. You remember the CC camp?
Oh, yeah, I've heard a lot about them. Oh. Well, before, you had to be a teenager for that, though. I want to hear about the early days. I mean, the 20s and the early 30s, going through the Great Depression. What was this place like? What was your life in Albuquerque like way back then?
We had a big ranch right uh-huh. there. My mom and dad, we had a lot of property. So we didn't feel the depression. So the government, the president, I don't know who the president was. Was it Abraham Lincoln? No.
You're not that old, Leo.
Anyway, the president made this for the young, like me, that I didn't want to go. I only went to the 8th grade. I got my CED later on. But I went on. Was young. They came with the CC camp. We had uniforms that we used to do, just like if you was in the service. That helped me a lot. For the Marines.
Well, which one did they send you? So this is the Civilian Conservation Corps.
Yes.
And there were several of these camps around
all
New
over.
Mexico and all over the country.
Yeah.
So which one did you go to?
The one that I was thinking, because I was kind of born here though at that time. Edis was the end of this growth, and from there it was all desert. But anyway, I think the camp was the Army National Guard. Uh-huh. You know, that's on Central and Wyoming, I think it is.
So this was right in Albuquerque, in
yes.
the city.
Yes. So, okay. So I was only maybe a year at that, because they used to pay us, I think, $40 a month. You keep $5, and the $40 you give to your parents. But my parents, they were living on the farm. We didn't, but he didn't even need it. But he would take the $40 and I, $5, 15 cents a beer. Man, you can go, you can drink all you want to. So we had a good time. I enjoy that. I enjoy being there. It kind of prepared me to when I went to the Marine, because I left home, you know. Yeah. I can still remember going to the Marine when I was 18 years old. There was a lot of young guys that, boy, you ought to see how many were going in at that time. They were all 17, 16 years old. My friend was 16 years old. And you can hear them sometimes kind of crying at night because they're not home no more with the grandmother or the mother. But me, I was so used to with the CC camp, so I was ready for the mm-hmm. Marine.
So how old were you when you went to the camp?
I must have been about 15, 16 years old at that time.
And what did they have you guys doing?
We do forest fires, which were very small, and we do kind of little dams where the arroyos come down and everything. It was heavy work, mm-hmm. but I got smart. I decided, hey, I want to work on the kitchen, and that way I don't have to be doing all that heavy work that they did it. And I enjoyed that we wear uniforms for the officers to feed them, and that was our job, do their beds, the cleanup. And I didn't have to be working like the other guys. And I did that for 2 years, and I enjoyed it very much. I had a very good friend that was with me, and we used to come and dance in Albuquerque like that. And I always wonder what happened to that friend of mine. But the war started, and then they closed it. They closed that because the war started, you know.
Yeah, they needed those young men in uniform,
yes.
Military-wise. Speaking of the war starting, I always like to ask every veteran this because it seems like most of them have a memory. December 7th, 1941.
Yeah.
Do you remember where you were and how you heard about the attack on Pearl Harbor?
I kind of remember like a dream that I was walking down Central near the Presbyterian Hospital. And here comes this young guy, you know, selling me extra, extra, war started, you know, extra, air Japanese attack in Pearl Harbor, you know. And that's when I find out about the war. But I start working at the base, and their bar, cleaning glasses and things like that.
Kirtland Base. Army Air Force Base back then.
Army, yeah. Exactly.
Right.
And I met an actor that was training there by that time when the war started, Jimmy Stewart. I didn't know actors, so later on I found out it was Jimmy Stewart. He used to sit out there by himself in a corner out there, drink a little beer or something, cheese and crackers, and I used to go take him like that. Later on, I found it was Jimmy Stewart that he even talked to me, maybe not very little, you know. Well, and he went through war and what, made a general?
A lot of people don't know he actually flew bombing missions in World War II.
Exactly.
But he was just another guy at the bar.
At the bar. Well, but when I joined the Marine Corps, we used to go loaded on a bus, 15, 20 of us guys, and they made a couple of tunes out of that. When you get a platoon, there's a whole bunch of Marines already that have gone through a training. And they had a saying. Every time they come a bus there, they had a saying, "You'll be sorry." So they was our turn to say to the other people that, like that. But that's the saying. And it's been known that that's what they used to say. "You'll be sorry."
I've heard that. Yeah.
But then I met another actor there. He came right after the second platoon of me, Tyrone Power.
Uh-huh.
He was there. So after doing all this exercise and everything in the evening when we're just taking it easy now, getting ready to go to bed, we get around him and he would tell stories. And I like to hear him talk because he had a beautiful voice, you know, and talk like that. But there was a guy from New York, kind of tall guy, and they didn't like the way we were going after him. Kind of jealous. So he started telling him stories about his life, you know. And everybody knew it, but he kept put it to the side, let him go. But then he started talking about his wife. There was a movie actress. He said, "That's enough. You can say about me all you want to, but you're not going to talk to my wife about that." Mm-hmm. And he jumps in. What we do, we spread him, call the sergeant, pick the boxing gloves. Okay, go at it. Tyrone Power knocked the hell out of him. We were so we were so glad, and the guy, he admitted and apologized.
How about that? Yeah.
So yeah. Those are the two actors that I met during the war. Well, with Bob Hope, I met him over there overseas. He was very nice.
Well, what about your decision to join the Marine Corps? What was it about the Marine Corps that attracted you?
I had a friend. He was 1 year older than me and was actually 1 year younger than my brother, but they was my brother's best friend. Nice looking guy. He had problems at home. He ran away from home just a little bit before the war. He joined the Marine also before the war. When he went back on furlough, hit with a uniform, with a Marine uniform, and all them girls going after him, "Hey, I want to join the Marine Corps." And he went through a couple of islands too, and then he went to Iwo Jima. He got killed there.
Oh, my goodness.
And I got his story right there, if you ever want to read the story. Alex Gonzalez used to live right. He was my neighbor, 2-3 houses from where I live.
Alex Gonzalez.
Alex Gonzalez was his name.
So he was the inspiration for you becoming a Marine.
Exactly.
Well, I want to come back around to that when you found out what happened to him.
Okay, but now I'm going to, a lot of people, you ask, how long did you go to the service, they asked me. Did you enlist or did you go for 4 years or what? I don't know if you ever heard it before. The way I went into the Marine Corps during the duration of war. Have you heard that one before?
Sure, yeah.
During duration of war, that's the way I signed. I only seen one guy that done that before. You don't see that many. They're all either volunteers or they went for 4 years or something. So I was wounded, and I was sent back to the States in Maryland as a guard there in Maryland on that submarine filling station. And the war was still on. I don't know how long I was there. And then the war ended. Sergeant came over with the paper, and he said, "You got to sign this." "What is that?" "Well, during the duration of war, now the war's over, now you got to go 4 years to the Marine Corps." And I said, I'm going home.
So they wanted you to reenlist.
Yeah,
right,
he wanted me to reenlist. Because in the first place, as much as I went fighting and made it this good sergeant, went through hell with a lot of sergeants. We got ambushed in New Britain, Cape Alaska, 2 months in the jungles. Man, we had rain. We got ambushed twice and everything, went through hell. And then over there, and yet I couldn't get a rank. I ended up PSC. And the reason I got mad with my sergeant because discrimination. I was the only Spanish guy. And I told him, he said, there was a place for two corporals. And he gave it to replacement that had gone, he gave it to them instead of me and then me fighting alongside with him, and he gave it to him. Mm-hmm. Boy, I went after him. I told him, I really told him off. I said, how can you do this to me? I should have one of those. He said, really? You're going home. This guy said they're going to go fight with a group to Okinawa. And I got a funny feeling that the platoon, I heard, I don't know how true it is, that they got all killed. So maybe that's what saved me, you know, the wound sent me home already.
Well, and I want to get to that, and you're giving us kind of a sneak preview of some of the things we're going to hear about Cape Gloucester, about Peleliu, where you were wounded, and more. But when you first went into the Marine Corps, was it what you thought it was going to be? Was it more difficult? How did they turn you into a Marine?
Well, being young at 18, you know, I call myself pretty strong. I remember they used to go to this big swimming pool and they put line us up four, five, six or whatever. And they said, can you swim? And you said, yeah, okay. And they go, can you swim? No. Push him in there and there, was, and then we had to pull him out. Uh-huh. Me, I was born here and I used to go to that river. We had cattle. I used to go out there when I was a little kid to take care of my cattle in the mountain. From Rio Grande Road to the river, it was all forest. So we used to go swimming there. And I keep calling it as a joke. I keep calling, we were just little kids. We were skinny dip. We didn't know nothing about bathing suits. No, there were no houses. Nobody was close by. So we enjoyed. So I was a good swimmer.
Uh-huh.
In fact, me and another guy, we raced just to see who would beat. We both even. Sometimes he beat him, sometimes beat him. But the other one, they couldn't even swim. So that's why I had it. And so after that training that I had on boot training in Camp Pendleton, uh-huh, I still got the picture there of the group and the number of the group that I got there when I was a Marine and boot training.
Oh, I can't wait to see your baby face on there. Yeah. We'll put that up at hometownheroesradio.com.
I had a hell of a time finding myself because you know, I changed and we all look alike. But anyway, so going to the Marines like that, I only shot one time when I was a little kid. My dad went downtown and I stole his shotgun and got on top of my horse. And I was a very proud little kid, you know, with a shotgun. So there was a little can out there. I went and got the shotgun from the top of the horse. Boom! Man, I fell down the horse. Couldn't find him for a week.
You scared him, huh?
Get the hell out of here. But anyway, so when I joined the Marines, I'm going to make sure. So I made sharpshooter. I got this little beautiful medal that I got as a sharpshooter. I found out I was a big mistake. Guess where they put sharpshooters?
Uh-huh.
In the front.
That's right.
There were three of us sharpshooters, myself and this Indian from Oklahoma, and I don't forgot where the other ones got. We changed like that, but it was not my turn. They both got killed.
But wow.
Because we were in front all the time, you know. I did catch one Japanese. I was about to almost kill a Japanese, but we needed Japanese for more information, you know. So they told us, if we can get him before you kill him, so I got a Japanese.
Captured him.
But he was looking the other way, and when I went behind him, when I heard a noise, and I went like this, and everybody stopped, you know. And then I signaled to the lieutenant that I think there's a Japanese in a little. It was not a shed. They left him there, this Japanese, and he had his back to me. When the Marines went like this, and then he told me to go ahead. And I got maybe about 30, 40 feet from him, and then I hollered at him. And he had his hands like this, and when I hollered, he turned around and looked at me, but this hand was kind of hidden from the thing that he was there, you know. And I said, I ain't going to take no chance. I was going to kill him. And then he went like this, you know.
Waved both hands around so you
could
see
him. Yeah,
uh-huh.
And then I found out that he had a problem with his feet. I don't know why they didn't kill him, so they left him like that. So we got him. He was so glad we got him, you know.
This was on Peleliu?
No, this was in New Britain.
New Britain.
New Britain, Cape Gloucester.
Well, and even before that, so you go through your training at Camp Pendleton, and they sent you overseas pretty quickly.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
Your first stop was Guadalcanal?
Yeah, well, when you put training, then they send you to different places. Guess what they sent me? They sent me to a paratrooper. And, well, I went out there, and I was trained. as a paratrooper.
Was that in New Jersey, Lakehurst?
No, that's at Camp Pendleton, Camp Elliott. So I went there, and I'd never been in an airplane close by. So they took us in the airplane, you know, with those two propeller, the P-47, whatever. And then you're supposed to look down, but not to jump. Gee, I see the little cars over there, you know, like they look like little things. I ain't going to, I don't want you to jump out of here. And I wasn't the only one. So I said that most of us, not 50%, most of us, we didn't pass. They gave you a test, a very short little test. They already went through the whole training. I knew how to pack a parachute very good. And the only way you can get away from it, either you fight with the sergeant, the trainee, or don't pass this test. 50% of it in passes that we didn't want to continue. we didn't want to be paratroopers. Some guys, boy, they want it because you do get the stars like a pilot. You
know? And you get extra pay.
Yeah. So, no, I didn't want to be fighting up there in the Japanese. So that's when I went to the infantry. And I went straight to Australia. And the first Marine Division, they just coming in when I was stationed there. And here come this Marines fighting from Guadalcanal. I didn't fight in Guadalcanal, but you ought to see the story they told me. I said, my God, what did I get into? You know, the way they fought there in Guadalcanal, they went through hell. But I did go to Guadalcanal for training. The Japanese were leaving, so I still got the medal, the ribbon that I
the
was
there. The campaign ribbon for Guadalcanal.
The campaign ribbon that I was there, but I can't say that I fought it. Uh-huh. But after there, I went to New Guinea, went through the jungles. We didn't find no Japanese in New Guinea. And then we went to New Britain, mm-hmm. Cape Horaster.
A battle you never hear too much about, but you will when we come back. Leo Griego, 95 years old, of Albuquerque, New Mexico, is our guest today. Find photos and a brief video of Leo online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
28. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 95-year-old Purple Heart recipient Leo Griego of Albuquerque, New Mexico. He enlisted in the Marine Corps at age 18 in 1942, ended up on Guadalcanal right after the fighting had scaled down there. The stories he heard from the Marines who had fought there were ominous, and soon he'd experience his own taste of combat. The 1st Marine Division's second amphibious landing of the war came at Cape Gloucester on the west end of New Britain, just east of New Guinea. Leo got there just after Christmas in 1943.
We fought there for 2 months. Rain, I mean, here we got the rain, you know, the little shit. Over there, they're buckets, you know. I mean, mud up to your nose. And we went through hell there. Like I said, we got ambushed twice. We got ambushed, and naturally, me being a shooter, the sergeant said, Griego, you stay with me. And I had me in, and the other one, the Indian, the one that got, we stayed with him, and you could see the bullets coming at us. And they had already shot one of the Marines, so all the Marines were going to see. We didn't expect to get ambushed. He got the machine gun and we knew how to load. He said, load me, air machine gun. He put a sweater around it and grabbed it and you know, and then we run back and kept on. And you can see bullets going all over, but while we were helping the other guys to keep going, you know. But it got so dark that by the time we found out that it got so dark, we had a hell of a time trying our line, you know. But we always had a code word that we supposed to use, you know. Come forward, I forgot what word we used, to be presented, you know, because they could kill us if we didn't know that word.
So you guys have a position, but you're ambushed by the Japanese and you're outnumbered, and someone has to, what you were describing with the machine gun, if I understand this is an air-cooled machine gun that has a tripod and you set it on the ground.
Yes, yeah.
But one of your guys wrapped a sweater around the barrel and picked it up?
Yeah, the sergeant, he wrapped the sweater and wrapped it up. But the next time we got ambushed, I was with this friend of mine. He has what they call a BAR. It's almost like a machine gun. You know, you load it with a big thing like that, 30-30, you know. And that's almost like, and he got a pipe almost like a BAR, you know, on it. And this guy, he was good. They only had two BAR in our group. But that guy, he loved that thing. Me, I wouldn't care. That thing was so heavy. But he loved it. He said, that's what I'm going to get, you know. And then I had another friend. Why I remember that guy, that's the only one I can remember. His name was Roscoe from Chicago. He stole a pistol. I don't know if he stole a picture from some officer. So he had a pistol with him all the time. And he has a regular gun. And he almost shot the sergeant because the sergeant had us go and put us like that in different. Every 5 feet, they put different ones like that. Everything was very quiet, and the sergeant went behind to check in on us, you know. So he didn't expect that, and he had his gun on his hand, and he just told him, how are you? He went, he almost shot him. Anyway, so we knew the Japs were way in front of us somewhere there, and I still remember we got there, and we heard that noise coming. We thought we would get an ambush. Man, we opened up and shot as much as before they come. Nothing came. Next morning, we got up to see what the Japanese we killed. One of those wild pig was walking out there, and boy, he was full of holes. So that was a funny thing. I always like to say something funny that helped because I hate to say what really was bad, you know.
Yeah.
Losing my friends like that, you know. I lost my best buddy, Jimmy Allen. He was my best friend. He used to like me a lot, and he was a fighter. The first fight in New Britain, he was right in the front when we got ambushed, and you can hear the Japanese. They had to, banjar, banjar. We had big grass, you know, we were hiding there. And he was right in the front line. I knew he was in the front. He saw an officer came with him with his big, beautiful saber. And he shot him and got that saber. Beautiful. Well, what a beautiful saber he got. We're always looking for sabers or the flag, you know. Souvenirs, if you want to call it. He had a good friend, and he got hit on the arm. So I'm quite sure he was going to send him back to the States. So he said, I want you to take my saber now because you're going to go home. Don't worry. He was a good friend of his. He said, you got my address? I'll take care of it. I'll take it with you, and then I'll give it. Okay, take it with you. Well, found out later, he said, you know, that guy, he kept it. He didn't give it. He found out from the family. He kept the sword. And then there was a magazine that I used to get on it. And there was a story there where that Marine had fought there and got a sword. And that was him. He was very proud that he's the one that shot it off. He lied about it.
He took credit for your
friend. Credit
for
the friend. And guess what? My friend got killed in Peleliu, so
wow.
He didn't know, he didn't even have a chance to get the saber for his friend. But I felt like running to that newspaper. I know where he got that thing, but I said, leave it alone.
Wow. It makes you wonder. And that's why I think it's so important that people like you tell us what you went through so we understand, because we didn't live through it. And we wouldn't have the country that we have if you guys didn't risk your lives and so many of your friends gave their lives. What was the hardest thing for you to deal with as a teenage Marine?
I don't know. One of the hardest things that I had at that time, I mean, I had very good friends after that. But here this guy came from Guadalcanal, and this sergeant, who was assigned to different platoon that came. When I was going overseas, it took us about 30 days to get from San Diego to Australia. The reason it took us so long, there were submarines, and they would stop that boat. No smoking, no noise, and we float for hours. And then you can hear the boat go, here we go again. But that's how long it took us. So we get there. When we were assigned to this one, and I met this Lieutenant Cox on board ship. We used to say that he was young too, but he had trained. He was an officer, Lieutenant Cox. I never forgot that guy. I made pretty good friends with him. I liked that. And he liked me too. So he was assigned to two platoons. Every morning we were called up for a roll call. So you go out there and stand on attention and say your name, you know, Grego and things like that. That sergeant, I always knew that he didn't like me because I'm the only Spanish or Mexican, if you want to call it, you know. I knew he didn't like me for that discrimination. And I was standing attention. He went and kicked my ass. And boy, I turned around and I didn't care who the heck was going. I was going to go after him for just cooking me. But my friends jumped at me and hold him back and hold me back. And then Lieutenant Cops came over. What's going on? And one of the guys said, no, this sergeant, he went and kicked Leo in the butt. Yes, he said, he was chewing gum. I was not chewing gum. I might have moved my mouth, I said, but I was not chewing gum. He just went behind me and kicked me. And when I, at that time, I was very Spanish, my very broken Spanish. I told Mom dirty words that I could talk in Spanish, you know. So he told me, don't you use those words no more. I'm sorry. And then he went after him. You, how dare you kick a man like that when he's on attention. Next time you even touch one of them, those stripes are going to go out. Don't you ever let me catch you doing that. Later I found out through my friends and the other Marines, they got him. And they told him, you know, we're going to go to war. We already went through Guadalcanal, went through hell over there. We're going to go again. If we're on the front line and then the Japanese are going to be, you wonder who the hell's shooting at me from behind. That's it. He never talked to me no more. And that is one that I didn't like, you know, but from there on, yeah. I like my friends. We were very good fighters and everything.
Yeah, and as an aside, so you're talking about your heritage. Because a lot of Albuquerque, old Albuquerque, is Spanish. Is your heritage Spanish or Mexican or both?
We call it our Spanish, you know. Uh-huh. I know my mom and dad, up to my grandpa's, we were the family tree. We were all Spanish, you know. But one time I asked my mom, I said, where did we really come from? And she just said, I don't know, we might have come from Mexico years ago. You don't know, you know. And I kept saying, you know, we call ourselves Spanish. And when Columbus came over, you know, to America, discover America, and he brought all those, what was it, all prisoners, remember, just men? So all those men, they didn't bring, there was no woman. Mm-hmm. So they got involved with the Indians, you know, and the ladies. And I found that out, that we do have a lot of Indian on us because of that. I think so. I don't know if I might be wrong, but I think that that's what we call Spanish, but even though we have a lot of Indian blood on us.
But so when you end up in the Marine Corps, in your unit, you had a lot of white Marines.
Yes.
And you were the only one that was Latino?
At that platoon, there was other one. There was there was the other one next to it, and there were two of them. They were from Colorado, I remember that. There was two of them there, but that's about it, you know. I was the only one on this platoon, but there were two on the other platoon. We used to go talk to them. They weren't very friendly.
So this Lieutenant Cox showed you by his reaction that he was not holding prejudice, that he didn't treat you any differently because of your ethnicity.
Yeah.
You did feel that some of the other Marines had a prejudice against you?
Just this one. Other one, they were all friends, and I made very good friends, very good friends. We used to play cards and joke around and get the boxing gloves and do that, and we were very united with the other, just this sergeant that I had the trouble with. But I didn't see him long, right after we hit New Britain, Cape Lester. After that, I didn't see him. I don't know what happened. I don't know if they put him in another platoon, or I don't know what happened to him.
You know, I always like to ask this question because I try to put myself in your shoes, and I think about a teenager who's coming from Albuquerque, and now he's half a world away, and you've had all this training, but it's not real yet. What was the first moment where something happened that underscored for you how high the stakes were? How real this was, how dangerous this was.
Well, like I said, it didn't take me long because after going through Guadalcanal and this guy's, I joined the Guadalcanal and I went, but I did not fight, but the Japanese were there. But right there in New Britain, Cape Alaska, when we got an ambush twice, you know, man, that it was scary.
And these are those infamous bonsai charges where they just all come at you?
Yes, they came at us, and then one time we were going on a patrol. We're not supposed to shoot. So if we find out where is there Japanese, if you see any, then we go and report it. Mm-hmm. Well, it got too dark. We didn't have a chance to go back. So it got dark, so the lieutenant, he put us 35 feet, you know, like that. And just about the time we were getting ready to eat, this one of the Marines had to go to the head, you know, the bathroom. And he decided to go like that. And there was a Japanese walking on that same trail, and they saw his shadow, but he shot him before he, and that did it. That's when they started, they were waiting for us to shoot. If it wasn't for that, I don't know if we would have made it. Probably they would have killed us all. But it happened that that guy went up there and find out. So, but they got shot. One guy got shot on that thing.
So this was a scouting patrol.
A scouting patrol. We used to do that, a lot of scouting patrol.
And the Japanese were there, but you didn't know it.
We didn't know it. We just happened to stop there. Mm-hmm. And I think they were waiting for us. And that's when the sergeant that I told you with the machine gun, boy, he was a fighter, Sergeant Strong. I never, when I joined, I met him as Sergeant Strong. And I told you my Spanish was not very good. He used to joke with me and just to make the other guys laugh. What's my name? Your name's Sergeant Strong? What's my name? Sergeant Strong. I couldn't say Strong. I said Strong. Uh-huh. So he would laugh. But he was a very good. They just teasing me, you know. And I didn't mind it, you know.
Well, here's another one for you that's off the beaten path, maybe. I know living in Albuquerque your whole life, you're a fan of New Mexican food, especially Sadie's right around the corner from your house, and you know the owner very well from church.
Sometimes I have visitors out of town. I have a lot of grandkids, nephews and everything. I think in California, they come here. They always like to go to Sadie's, you know, and that's it, you know. But she is a wonderful person, that Betty Jo. I give her a lot of credit because she's very generous lady.
Well, and I'm guessing when you are in New Britain, you don't have any food, anything like the red chili or green chili at Sadie's.
Well, they used to give us a package like that, a little can of, it could be anything, hash or something. Well, over there on the jungle, there's a chili piquí, just a little chili this big. I used to get that and dry it. And every time they give me this, I put that chili in there. Both that make the taste good.
So little chili peppers that are growing in the jungle.
Yeah, it's wild. It's a wild chili. I make it and dry it, you know, put a little pouch, you know, and I put it with that. And then the other guy, hey, let us have some of that. You guys get your own. I mean, but then again, they would give us a candy bar, would come a little candy. I love chocolate candy bar, and 4 cigarettes. I never was a smoker. So I used to say, hey, 1 cigarette, how many candy bars can I get? I love chocolate. So they save the chocolate bar so they can get 1 cigarette from me. I never was a smoker.
I know we're going to hear about when you were wounded at Peleliu, but I'm curious if there were moments before that where you look back now and say, hey, it could have been it right there. That was a really close call.
Yeah, especially when we got ambushed at New Britain first. Twice we got ambushed like that. I thought you could see the bullets going when we were being attacked. You know, we were lucky to get out of that. Mm-hmm. We were attacked twice. It was scary. We were on that grass crawling, and this Marine had a roll of wire that was sticking it to the front because they always to get more, you know, in case we need help for the rockets to be thrown or something. And my friend Roscoe was, he was about 10 feet in front of me. And this guy had just passed me with that thing going, crawling like that. And Roscoe turned, he said, get down. And then went like that. A bullet hit him here and broke all this thing. Then I had to get that wire, but then they didn't need it. But that was scary. I mean, the bullets going right through that grass.
Through the grass is one thing. Through the flesh is another. And that's what Leo Griego would experience at Peleliu. If you visit hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find a video of Leo showing us the scars, still visible more than 75 years after he was wounded while serving with the 1st Marine Division. He'll explain the entire scenario when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. sets. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with 95-year-old Leopoldo Griego of Albuquerque, New Mexico. We've heard how he left school to work in a CCC camp, later working as a civilian at Kirtland Army Air Corps Base, where he had some memorable encounters with a couple of Hollywood stars turned servicemen. At age 18, Leo joined the Marine Corps. He spent time on Guadalcanal, New Guinea, and New Britain before a battle that would change his life and thousands of others. In September 1944, the 1st Marine Division was tasked with trying to seize an airstrip on a small coral island in the Palaus called Peleliu. Had you ever heard of this place before? Had you seen it on a map? Did you have any idea?
No. Yeah. I didn't know what Peleliu was until I got there, you know. They never tell you exactly, you know. We're not supposed to know where we're But the first wave, boy, those Japanese, they were throwing rockets, and they were good. You can see the hitting, the burning, and the Marines floating that was hitting, you know. We were on the LST, they call it, to get us in there. So we were going out there, and they were hitting us. And all of a sudden, one hit right in front of us. The boat went like this at the Forhaya. Boy, that guy from the Navy, he took it like this out of the way, and you're going to see the bombs. We were lucky to get out of that one. So he took it, so then we started going like this, you know, on the boat, you know.
You're zigzagging to try to dodge fire?
Yeah, but we couldn't go in that deep in because it was all coral on the bottom.
Right.
So the ship stopped, I don't know how many feet, quite a feet from where he stopped. Because it finally hit the coral. They point like that, and I jumped to the side because they were shooting. The first Marine, they're leaving, they're going in front. I think they got killed right there.
Which wave were you?
Well, I was in the third wave. So the first wave couldn't make it. The second would make it. The third. So what left of this, what left of us, we finally got together, and then we all went in together. And
so, but the guys who went in front of you, heavy, heavy casualties.
Heavy casualties.
And you're hung up on the reef. The ramp comes down.
And I jump alongside.
Because you knew in that moment that if you went out the front, you'd probably get killed?
Yeah, exactly. The water was up to here with my gun and going on that reef, but I made it. And I was crawling there on that sand, and Marines were, I mean, they were dying all around me. I mean, the Japanese had the machine guns. They'd been trained. They knew how to do this. Even though our Navy was throwing all those, but they were missing them a lot, you know. They didn't hit. So I remember that a tank came in, and it got stuck. And I could hear those bullets, so I went down to close to the tank on the bottom. And then I said, no, I got to get. And they kept saying, get off the beach, you know, because they were coming. So I saw this guy get up, and there was a little hill, you know, and we were supposed to go over that hill. So he went up there, and I was just about to go when I saw him go. They shot him, went down. I don't know if they killed him or what, but he just dropped. I said, no, I can't go there yet. Maybe wait a few more minutes. Then another guy went, and he went through. Then I said, well, maybe. Then I went through. So I went through, and we got together on the runway. So we started digging our foxhole pretty deep. Thank goodness. We were digging a hole there because the Japanese were on the other side of the runway, and we were on this side. And like I said, I don't remember what I spent that night. But I remember I left my bag about from 10, 15 feet like that. And I went and grabbed it to bring it back to my hole. As soon as I was crawling like this, and I grabbed the bag like this. Pew, the bullet hit right behind my nose right there. Man, I turned around. I even left the bag out there. I don't think I touched ground in the foxhole. And I stayed on that foxhole. Good thing it was deep enough. And the reason I say that, because my good friend, that Indian friend that I met before from Oklahoma, very quiet Indian, that Japanese guy had a bullet right there. Man, he did. It was a sniper. So I stayed down like that.
So the sniper killed your Native American friend with a shot through the forehead.
Yes, right through the forehead. And he killed the other one. I don't know where the other one was killed, but I know he killed two for sure, but I think they told me he killed more.
And he almost got you. It was inches away from your nose.
So I stayed there for quite a while, and then I saw a Marine walking and said, "Hey, how's everything going? Why?" "Well, I think there's a sniper." "No, come here. I'll show you. Look at him." They finally got it. He's hanging down way over there. Somebody finally found it and shot him. He was hanging down.
He had been up in the tree, and now he's hanging from the tree.
He was.
And that first day on Peleliu, I believe you told me that you believe now you may have saved a friend of yours' life by applying first aid to his ear?
Yes.
What happened there?
Well, when all this was going on, then they finally said, "Okay, let's go." We start walking, and man, you could see the Marine just dropping all over.
So you're moving toward where the Japanese are at the other side of the runway?
Exactly. They had a pillbox they were waiting on. After finding that Marine, they were shot on the ear. Afterwards, I went out like that, and the other guys, I don't know, I never found out if they were dead or whatever, something happened. But there was a great crater. Man, I jumped inside that crater because they were shooting, dropping the Marines all over.
Well, tell me about your friend's ear.
Well, he was a corporal, and a corporal, he was in charge of three more PFC, so he was our corporal. When they told us to get going, we all started going together, you know, and we were just zigzagging like that because you could see the bullets going all over, the Marines dropping all over. And I remember we dropped down because we saw the bullet like that, and that's when I told you they hit him like that.
Dropped down with you, but the bullet hit his ear.
Yes. So I grabbed him and put this thing on it, and there was not like a foxhole, but big dirt pile of dirt like that. So I pull him into behind that dirt, you know. So I don't know how long he stayed there enough for him to go back, you know.
But his ear was dangling?
Yeah, it was dangling on here.
All but the lobe had been severed from his head.
Yeah, all of it but him, because he was like this, you know. And he said, "Well, it's just a scratch. I said, "Okay, get going." So I left.
So you tell him it's just a scratch, but you actually had to pick the ear back up and tape it to his head?
We always carry bandages with us, you know. Anyway, after I was hit and everything, and I went back to the camp and everything, way after the war, way after he was over there, and he said, "Hey, I want to talk to you." I said, "Why?" "Remember you said it's just a scratch? Look, I don't have a damn ear. They cut it off. It was just hanging here." But I don't know if I save his life. I said, "Get behind that dirt there," and I continue going. But then jump on that hole. There was a guy there, and he said, "Why did you come here? Why? Look at the up there." I said, and then he put his helmet on his rifle. Look, we were trapped in a great big crater. There were more Marines coming in there. And thank goodness a Marine that came in there had a radio. And our tanks were right behind us, you know. And he called the tank. They said, "We're so-and-so. There's a pillbox over there. They're shooting at us." And he said, "Yeah." He said, we see it." Boy, that tank went over there and pew, blew him up. Then we had a chance to get out of the run up there.
And but if the tank hadn't come, you would have been trapped in that crater because anybody who tried to get up would be shot.
Yeah. In fact, one of them did. One guy went in there. He said, "I'm going to get out of here." I said, "You can't." We told him he's going to get shot. And we could see him. He went up and started running. You ought to see the bullets going behind him. And he finally made it to another north, and then he went over. He made it through.
Wow.
But I wouldn't take the chance. But good thing that tank saved our life. And that's when I got hit after that.
Yeah, and you made the statement that you don't remember going to sleep that night.
That's right.
Maybe you didn't even sleep.
Yep. Who knows? I don't know nothing.
Because it was so intense and nonstop.
The sniper that shot at me, you know, did it happen that day or did it happen the next day? I don't know. I never know what happened that night.
Tell me about what happened when you got hit.
Well, I was right in the front lines, you know, and then we knew the Japs were just right in front of us. They were dropping mortars at us, you know, and one of them, motor drop, I heard, I think there were four Marines, right? It hit right where they were, and they killed all four Marines right away. And wounded three. I was one of the wounded ones. There was a guy next to me. He hollered at me. He said, Grigo, I'm hit. And I said, "I am too." I said, I was holding myself like this, you know.
Holding
my right shoulder, you know. I still got a scar right here and a scar right here. I thought for a year it was a bullet. Found out it was shrapnel. Somehow it went there and it went out because it had to go up. But if it were going to hit there, it would go like they would have killed me. This way, he would have killed me. So he must have hit the bone and cut my muscles here because I'm always hurting. I'm hurting. My arm right now is hurting, you know.
Because you have a wound in your right chest.
Right.
And also in your right arm just below the shoulder. Yeah. So you're saying it had to come across. Otherwise, it would have hit your heart or something like that.
It's really strange that it happened that way. I wouldn't have known that maybe shrapnel hit me or still being in there. But when they took me to, when I got hit, all the wounded, they had a ship with a big red cross. And then they would take you to an island. So that's where they was taking all the wounded. So they took me there. So I was there for quite a while. But I still remember I was laying down there in bed there a few days after. It smelled, it stink, you know. I was smelling this, and I told the doctor. So what he did, he put a cloth in there, like a drainage, if you want to call it. Uh-huh. And when I told them, he just pull that out. So that I knew that it was a hole right through like that. There was nothing in inside of me like that.
So there was a cloth all the way from one wound to the other?
Yeah, this far.
So an entry wound and an exit wound.
Exit, exactly.
And they had left the cloth in there.
The doctor put that cloth for drainage. I'm not a doctor, but I guess to help it drain the blood that's in there or the dirt out of the shrapnel or whatever.
So you told us a little bit about what the wound ended up being, but what about the moment? What were you doing when you were hit? What did it feel like? Can you help us understand what that's like?
Yeah, well, like I said, we were on the front lines there. I think island was all mostly coral rock, so you couldn't dig foxholes. So you get rocks and make your own, and that's what I already had done that. And if I remember, a guy in the Navy, a Spanish guy from Texas on the Navy, the ship that took us over, he gave me a can of pork and beans on the ship. So I got my pork and beans. I got hungry. I've been going through. I got hungry, and I put the pork and beans there. And as I remember correctly, I went and got my dagger. I had the dagger to open it, and that's when I got hit. I didn't even get my pork and beans.
You're just about finally going to eat.
Yeah, finally going. So that's when I start crawling.
So what did it feel like when you get hit? What did you feel?
Well, I didn't know how bad it was. It's kind of hard to say. This went through because I didn't even know it went through. I don't know. All I know that my jacket was torn and I was bleeding very bad. And I went like that crawling.
Holding
like,
your other hand over the right side where you're bleeding.
And I left everything, rifled and everything. And I start crawling behind the lines. And here this boat, I don't know what they call it, the one that has tracks on it. It goes in the land and water.
An Amtrak.
Yeah, they were picking up wounded Marines. So they happened to be there, you know, and he had that thing. And I still remember crawling in there, and he puts that thing up, and you could hear that bullet hitting that boat, man. And then he took off to the sea, and then the ship, like I told you, with a big red cross. And I remember, I guess they had like a big hoist. They put you in, and then they'll take you up like that and took you into the ship. And I was still holding myself like this. They haven't done nothing because the Marines were worse than I am. And then the boat was going like this.
Rocking back and forth.
And then all of a sudden, the boat was going like this. I passed out. I had lost a lot of blood. I had a big, great Navy guy from my feet. Hey, wake up, wake up. My feet. I woke up, and that's when they took care of my... And from there, I don't remember what happened. I don't remember if I passed out or what. But I ended up in that island where they were taking us wounded, you know.
So if that amphibious vehicle hadn't come by right when it did, you probably would have bled out.
Exactly. We were on the front line. They were killing all of those. I mean, they had us over there. I don't know how. I think they finally, what they did, they finally brought those flamethrowers. I think that's the way they finally threw the flame to get those Japanese from the attack. I don't know. All I know, they took me out. And the war had ended for me already.
How much pain were you in?
Actually, I didn't feel any pain. I don't remember saying, boy, it really hurt. It hurts more now when I'm sleeping. Like right now, it hurts, you know.
What about the recovery? How long were you hospitalized? How long did it
well,
take?
Well, I must have been quite a while by because it kind of healed quite a bit. So I went back to my outfit. So we went out to the rifle range again. I got me another rifle, and I was going with the rifle like that. And I said, I went like this. Worse. When I went like this, and I hit the cover, went like this. It's just like a hammer hit me here. I fell backwards, and then my heart started going like this. And the sergeant said, what's the matter with you? And then I told him, I said, I was here. Go see a doctor right now. So by that time, as far as I know, I was healed. But when that rifle hit there, man, I was swollen this big.
So the recoil hit you right where you'd been wounded and
exactly.
It swelled up. Yeah.
So anyway, I went to see the doctor, and the doctor said, oh, man, it's pretty bad, you know. How did it happen? I said, how long have you been here? He said, I've been here about 2 years. I told him I had been working out and all that. You know what? You've been here long enough. I'm going to send you home. I could have kissed that guy. That's the sweetest word I ever heard, man. He sent you home because I couldn't fight anyway because of my arm. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, all those Marines, they went to Okinawa. A lot of them were killed. They were all replaced. You know, and later on, I found that they killed all of them, my whole platoon that I wanted. Mm-hmm. That's what they told me, that they ran into a machine gun nest and they were all killed. So I probably would have been killed too if I would have gone through Okinawa.
And the reality is quite a few guys that you knew were killed.
Yeah, well,
and
yes.
You talked before about your friend Jimmy Allen.
Jimmy Allen was my best friend. Jimmy Allen, the way he died, when the tank came at us at Peleliu at the runway, one tank ran over him halfway. And a friend of mine came, hey, Greg, Jimmy wants to talk to you. He got hit by a tank ran over him. So I went over there, and they had him on a stretcher. And he was laying down on that stretcher. And he said, hey, well, he said, I guess this will send me home. He said, see, you know where I live. You got my address. Be sure and see me because I think it's the end of the war of me. Okay, I told Jimmy. We'll kill that. So it was kind of sad when they found out that he was killed. Her sweetheart wrote me, and mother, she wrote me a letter stating how friends we were together, you know.
So you talked about him calling you over and you seeing him on a stretcher. He's been run over by a tank. Did you know he was not going to make it, or did that news shock you later?
After the way I found out about him, when I saw him on that stretcher, I saw he was pretty bad. When I think the one drank went halfway out of his body like that. So when I got hit, when I went back to the camp before the rifle, you know, boy, the first thing I went to see, they have there the list of the ones that were killed, the limbs where they were wounded. So all this wounded man, I went looking for him. Where is he? Couldn't find him. And then when I went there, the kill, there he was. He died on board ship.
That really hit me hard.
That really hit me. I losing my best friend like that because we were so close. We used to go get the gloves and play around with the other. We were fighting, you know.
Uh-huh.
You know the old trick? Hey, your shoes unbuttoned. Really? And he went over around. Yeah. He went trying to kiss at me, and I would laugh. We were laughing. We always laugh about that. Your shoes untied.
Mm-hmm.
Really? Boom! I hit him like that. So we were very close to Jimmy.
So you had the chance, 60 years after you were wounded on Peleliu, to go back there some other World War II veterans.
I just had to go see that. The Navy had already bombed every coconut tree, the airport and everything, you know. 60 years later, it was a jungle again. I could not even find the runway.
Because when you were there, everything was bare because it had been bombarded so much.
I was trying to see that big hole that I had that job, but they probably covered because they used to use the runway later, you know.
So it looked very different. But what did you experience there 60 years later? What did you get out of that?
I enjoyed it quite a bit because they were waiting for us. Man, we had parties all over. And Peleliu is way on the bottom. There's a whole bunch of islands. And Korora is the capital of Palau, I think is what they call it. Peleliu is the one on the bottom where we did the fighting.
The inhabitants of the Palaus expressed some gratitude towards you guys.
Oh, man, they went all out. They had a big building that the Japanese had built, like a fortress. Might as well call it a fortress. The walls were this thick.
Couple feet wide. Yeah.
Concrete. And the Navy, they tried to, they hit it, and they finally made a hole on it. And we used to go see that where they made that big hole. Rebar were this thick.
Like 2 inches in diameter?
2 inches in diameter. No wonder they never could penetrate. So they made that into a museum.
Uh-huh.
And that's what that year that I went there. And they were getting a lot of stuff that the Japanese left, the Americans, you know. They're finding a lot of stuff there, and they were put in there.
Did that trip change your perspective on the significance of what you'd done all those years earlier?
It should make me proud that I went through here and thank the good Lord that I'm still alive. My mother prayed for me, and this is hard because somehow they sent a letter to my mom that I was wounded. And I don't know who sent it. Maybe they, I guess that's normal, what they do when you're wounded. Mm-hmm. Oh, my mother, she said that she cried every single day. She wondered if I didn't have an arm, I was blind, I had legs and all that. And good thing I wrote a letter right away and said, don't worry, Mom. I've still got all my bed, just a little slight wound. She was glad to hear that from me. But that was hard to, she was very hard to take, you know.
Well, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us a story that only you could tell us. Is there something that you would say you're most proud of?
I'm proud as a Marine that I went as a Marine. I'm very proud of myself that I went through war. I'm glad I didn't get killed, you know. I could have been killed a lot of times, you know, and I'm glad I missed all that. I'm glad that I would join the Marines.
Once a Marine, always a Marine. Leo Griego, 95 years old. If you're ever in Albuquerque, New Mexico, maybe you'll have the privilege of shaking his hand. Check out the photos and video online at hometownheroesradio.com, where the podcast version of this episode also includes a few additional anecdotes from Leo that would not fit into our radio time. Thanks so much for spending this hour with us. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.